Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and today sitting side chair is John Copenhaver. How you doing?
I'm doing well, Al. How are you?
I'm always good. Not really, but I say it. Okay, so now we've got exceptional writer. We've got Wendy Hurd on the line. How are you doing, Wendy?
Oh, wow. Thank you so much. I'm doing really well. Thank you.
So, Wendy, this is the first time you've been on this show, so make sure your seatbelt's in there tight.
Okay.
No, actually, this is interesting. So you've got three books out, it looks like. How did it start for Wendy? How did writing start for Wendy?
Oh, God. I started writing really young. Right out of high school, I was like, I'm going to write a great American novel. And I did not write a great American novel. I wrote a really terrible novel by an American. Okay. And it was called Circles, and it was about the circles we traveled in getting to know ourselves. And that one just never got published for some reason. And then I took a long break of sadness before I started writing again. And then I got to it. And then I actually, like, you know, tried to learn the industry and tried to figure out how to write a book with a plot and all those good things. Oh. And then it took years, though, like years and years of writing books and not getting them published, et cetera. I think my first published book is like my seventh book that I finished.
So what was it about writing that kept you going? Because I'm just saying, okay, so first of all, you put out this book and in your mind, it's going to be a great, great book and everybody's going to love it. And it doesn't happen. And then you put out several other books after a little depression crash, and you're still trying to get this book published. But what was it about writing that would make you go through all that and not just give up?
That's a great question. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
I think it's like one of these things where, you know, sometimes, like, for example, I like other creative things. I have a degree in painting. I did music for a long time. You know, there's a lot of creative things that I really enjoy. But for some reason, writing seems to be the thing that, how can I explain it? It's like I carry it around with me. Writing's the one that goes everywhere with me. If I'm in a bar, I'm making stories about the people in the bar. If I'm, for example, I got my COVID vaccine because I work in education yesterday. And I just got that yesterday. And
Congratulations.
Thank you. And they're giving out the vaccines in an abandoned IKEA. And it's like the most dystopian thing I've ever seen. And I'm sitting here, and there's this a place where you sit after you get your shot to make sure that you don't like go into anaphylactic shock or like die. And so you're sitting like 12 feet apart from all these people just facing forward in this abandoned IKEA. And it's like, it's a story. You know what I mean? Everywhere you go, there's just a story, a story, a story. And so I don't know. It just, it's like, if I didn't write them down, I'd just be writing it in my head all the time. So I might as well write them down and turn it into a craft.
Wow. No, I'm always curious, because when people are faced with a struggle of trying to accomplish their dream, what's the point that you do give up? You know, like how far would you go? So I find that,
yeah,
really, you know, it's interesting to see how important it is to a writer. And so you said learning the craft, but is the craft of writing as important as the story?
Okay, so I don't know if I'm going to have people necessarily agree with me, but I really felt like when I stopped thinking of it as an art and started thinking of it as a craft, that's when I started to become an actual writer. Like when I stopped thinking that the things I was saying were important and that my ideas were important and that, you know, that there was such a thing as fine art. And when I let go of the idea of anything like that, and I just started trying to consider it like a construction worker building a structure. Mm-hmm. And when I got all of that ego out of it and got less precious about it, so I could throw out a whole book if it wasn't good. I could throw out chapters. There weren't any precious lines in there that couldn't just get reused some other time. You know, there weren't any characters that I couldn't just plug into a different plot at another time. Like everything kind of became less precious to me. And then I was like, once I kind of got into that mindset, I was like, now I can get to work. Now I can become a writer who can see my own work critically and become, you know, less egotistical, and I can actually grow now. And that's when I started actually writing books that eventually could get published, you know?
Hmm. Well, that's me, exactly. I totally agree. I understand.
Yeah.
But this is the show that everyone loves to hate. So, but
I agree with you, Wendy, yeah, too. So you've got two folks.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, because I write some books that are completely commercial, and I don't mean that in a bad way, but it's the right formula. It's just the right thing. And then there's some books I feel are more important. But the things I think that I write that are really good don't do near as well as the others. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's funny because the books that I have loved, or like the stories that I have loved that I have had, are not necessarily the stories that readers have connected with the most, you know? And so you just kind of got to put stuff out there. You don't know what's going to stick. You don't know what's going to be popular. It's like something that's really precious to you. It maybe it's just for you, you know, you just really don't know. Yeah, you just have no way of knowing.
What kind of writer do you consider yourself then? As in like, what, like, kind of, like, are you, do you, what, where do you sit in, like, in fiction? What kind of area do you sit in?
My agent will tell you upmarket thrillers. And every time she tries to explain it to me, I'm like, oh yeah, I get it. I know what you mean. And I'm like on the other end of the phone smiling at myself in the mirror, like, I don't know what she means. But I kind of know. I mean, it's like, there's really straight commercial thrillers, right? Where, you know, it's not about necessarily anything but the plot, right? It's a fun ride. It's an entertaining ride. There's not like a message or necessarily like a theme, metaphor, you know, that type of thing. It's really just a straight commercial story, which I enjoy those very much. And I don't mean to say that because I think my books are quite commercial. So in no way am I feel like you can't even talk about that type of book without making sure people know that you're okay with it. Cause we can be so snobbish about books where the purpose is to entertain, which I don't know why we are so opposed to art being enjoyable, but for some reason we feel like it has to be kind of punishing in order to be good. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think especially now we're in that time where it's easier to put someone down, you know, if you want to raise yourself, it seems like a lot of people lift themselves up by saying bad things about others. And commercialism is a great way of slamming another writer if you maybe they sell more than you and you don't like it, you think you're better. It's like, well, her, yeah, she's commercial.
Yeah. It's like if something has wide appeal, there's almost this like it appeals to the masses. Like the masses are like the dirty little masses, like the small people who don't understand what's real art. You know, that's like, I don't know. I'm very opposed to that. You know, actually try very intentionally not to use 50 cent words in my books, because the last thing I want is someone to read this and to feel like I'm not talking to you. This book's not for you. It's for someone smarter than you. Like that's the last thing I want anyone to ever feel. And so I actually will edit making sure I'm not ever doing that. You know, I want someone to feel very comfortable reading this book if they're not someone who, you know, has memorized the thesaurus.
I would say that that's two-sided, but, you know, because when you're putting together a book and you want it to be as, you want to catch as many people as possible. You want them to feel like they're not in a different level, that they can come into your book and enjoy it and get through the story and leave with a certain feeling maybe. But so how important is it that you have feedback, like your reviews, for instance, you know, because this is the online time where, you know, people will write things about you all over the place. Do you follow up what kind of people say about you?
Sometimes, yeah. I have a phase when the book first gets on like NetGalley and it first goes onto the review sites, I'll like keep it. I'm so excited that it's on the review sites, you know, and that's a really exciting moment because it's the first time it's been out in the world. And I sort of can't help but see what people think of it, you know, like what's your first one, the second one, the third one. By the time it hits like 100, I'm usually very, now I know what people love and hate about it. I've got it. Like I've come to peace with the things that are bothering people. And I've, you know, gotten a little, you know, happiness from the things that people enjoy. And I can kind of step away and then I'll focus just more on like, what are the trade reviews and what are the like larger reviews saying? Just the trade reviews are like a whole heart pounding, you know, industry thing that probably no reader will ever pay attention to, but they're important. You know, they kind of determine how your book is viewed in the community and how will it be shelved and how will libraries feel about it, and all these things feel kind of important with those. So, yeah.
Yeah, and they're a bunch of nasty people. They are. They've been good to my book twice, Bobby.
They have. Stuff, but... I've been lucky, but I also feel like it's so, I don't know. I feel sometimes like they can be a bit like petty or something. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. But I've been lucky, so I shouldn't complain.
Well, one book they were kind of in the middle, not really nice, not, and it's one of my best sellers. And I've done what, four TV shows on it. You know, so who knows? So maybe I'm just too commercial. I think that's the problem. When you get into NetGalley and you get into Publisher Weekly and stuff like that, they're kind of top drawer, highbrow, you know. It's kind of the way they treat you. Well, it can be really hard.
Well, it's so interesting because it's like one person doing, it's just another point of view, but they're behind this big, you know, they're Kirkus or, you know, PW or whatever. So it feels like this whole organization is sort of, you know, saying something about your book, but really it's just another person, you know, someone who's I guess skilled, but it's
you take their name down and you find them on social media and you attack them.
No,
that's just you know.
You hear stuff like that. You hear of authors like stalking reviewers. I've been in moments where I've heard authors say that they had like stalked reviewers and stuff like that. Like, oh, I saw this, and then I found her over here, and then I saw what she, you know, I found her on Facebook, and I'm like, that's not cool. No. You know, you put something out there. People are allowed not to like it. It's cool.
Right,
you know, and you got to be okay with that. You can't put something out into the public world and expect everybody to like it. It's just, it will never happen.
I heard a good joke yesterday. It said that all 1-star reviews are just failed writers.
Oh,
Oh, I know. I see, this is why people love to hate me.
Really bored people.
Yeah. I was going to say, yeah.
Well, I think it's all good. It just, yeah. I try not to even notice them myself nowadays, as long as the overall
you
average
do.
Is good. Yeah, now I've kind of got to a point that I don't really look for it. If I happen to come across one, that's fine. But I certainly don't look for them anymore. I look at the overall, like if you have 100 reviews on something and you've got like a 4+ average, well, that's great. I'm happy. If 100 people read it and give me, a 4-star, I'm thrilled, you know. So it's not really, I try not to get into detail myself, but, it happens. So, you know, your very first book, that would be, let's see, Hunting Annabelle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where did the idea for that come from?
That book was kind of funny. I had, as you heard me say, I had been writing for a long time. I had not been published. I was like, I'm at peace with this. This is just kind of my journey. I'm going to write, and it's probably never going to get published at this point, right? So I kind of decided I'm just going to write what I feel like writing. You know, I mean, what do I really have to lose? I mean, I'll write something that's, you know, a genre like a thriller or something. You know, I had known that I wanted to write in that space, but I was like, I want to write something really different, something I have never seen in that space before. And it doesn't matter because it's probably never going to get published. No one's ever going to read it. So I wrote Hunting Annabelle, which is set in the 80s, and it has a male protagonist, and he has a lot of mental health issues, and he falls for this girl who disappears, and the book is him trying to find her, but wondering if he might have had something to do with it himself. So it's that like unreliable narrator thing, but it's very artsy. He's an artist. He sees auras. It's very 80s. I mean, the whole thing felt so artsy and weird. It was really just for me. And then I had a draft of it. And then I got really badly injured, like very badly injured. I fell and I broke my wrist and my hip. And so I had one whole side of my body that I could not use. So I couldn't even use crutches. If you can picture it, like I had one hand and one leg, but they were on the same side of my body. So I couldn't wheel a wheelchair and I couldn't use crutches. I could use one crutch or I could slide around on my butt. That was what I could do for 3 months. And I rewrote Hunting Annabelle during that 3 months. And it was a dark revision. Like that's when it got pretty dark, you know, and then I signed with my agent and it sold. So sometimes it's like, maybe you really just have to find that raw thing inside you and just write for that, you know, I guess is maybe.
Or do you think it was a sense of freedom? Because at that point,
yeah, maybe.
I don't care if anybody published me or not. I'm just going to do it. Isn't that kind of like a sense of freedom of I'll put down what feels right to me and wherever it goes, it goes.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you kind of write your very personal and specific brand of truth and eventually, you know, maybe one of them will go, you know? Yeah.
What do you want people to get out of your books? Like when, if I pick up Hunting Annabelle, for instance, and I start reading it, is there a certain feeling or a certain, I don't know, a certain thought that you, other than the story itself, that at the end of the book I should have?
Yeah, Hunting Annabelle was a really special one for me because I wanted to talk a lot about how we perceive good and evil and how fuzzy it can be sometimes when you are the evil or you are the good. You know, I wanted to get inside the head of someone who would normally be shelved under evil, but make him the protagonist and make him very sympathetic and make it just kind of upend some of our thoughts about what it feels like to be in that seat. And I'm not sure also, I mean, there's a lot in there. I lived in Texas for a few years. So there's a lot in there too about Texas and about just, you know, cultural stuff in there about like, you know, what it felt like to be a Californian in Texas and stuff like that. Yeah. So, yeah.
So are you believing, are you taking the stance that evil, you're born evil, or it's a spiritual thing, or is it something that you, it's a behavior you learn, you think?
That's what I wanted to unpack a little bit. It's and like, I'm, the reason I'm stuttering a little is I'm like, how do I say this without any spoilers? But like, you're inside the head of someone that you grow quite fond of and you grow quite sympathetic to. But as the story goes on, you start realizing that this person you almost feel like you've been tricked into sympathizing with someone that you wouldn't have if you had been given maybe all the info up front. And I wanted to do that on purpose to sort of, I don't know, unpack some of that and maybe challenge, I guess, put a little mirror up for the reader and ask more questions than answer about what do you think about good and evil? Now, what do you think? Like, does this change anything? Like, I just wanted to maybe ask a lot of questions about that.
That's
interesting. Go for it. Yeah.
Kill Club, which is your second book, I'm very familiar with, and I love. It's a great book. It also is playing with a lot of the sort of moral questions. So it's funny you were talking about, you know, what upmarket thrillers are, but I think there are big moral questions going through your books that, and certainly Kill Club is deep in those questions as well. Do you want to talk a little bit about it?
Yeah. I would say that Kill Club is a real, Kill Club is a very straight and easy question, right? It's like, how far would you go? And how is it wrong to go this far when the person in question is like, is it wrong to kill an evil stranger if the person you're doing it to save is an innocent, you know? And like, what are the, what are our thoughts about that? Like, where does that gray morality hit each of us? And the Kill Club is a book I had been wanting to write ever since becoming a mother myself, because, you know, when I had a child, it kind of brings this whole new person inside of you who will, you know, that mother bear thing where it's like, I have never had anyone in my life that I would, you know, literally like gnaw my arm off for, you know, like that I can see myself putting, you know, doing stuff like that to save. And then I actually read this news story that really got the book started for me about this young mother whose daughter's father, she had a baby, a son actually, and her baby's dad was killed in the military. And so she was alone in this trailer in this rural area. And the next thing you know, she's like got this intruder breaking into her house and she has to shoot him while on the phone with 911. And it's this whole thing. And at the end of the whole thing, she's being interviewed and she says, no one is more dangerous than a mother protecting her baby. Mm-hmm. And I found that so interesting. And I thought it really made me go back to that thing I had, you know, been asking myself, like, is there a limit? Is there a limit to what I would do? I don't know that there is a limit. Like, would I cross into really dark moral territory if my daughter was on the line? You know, and all those questions I thought would be really interesting for a thriller readership, because most of our readers are women and most of them are middle-aged women, so probably have children. And so I thought this is a concept that will really like resonate with people.
Wow. Yeah. You know, I was going to say on your first book there, with The Hunting Annabelle, it reminds me of, I interviewed a serial killer just about a year ago for a book, and he has a new wife. And so, and he has had her for about 15 years, but this is a guy that's killed 7 people and he's raped 2 girls and he just a terrible past, but she sees him as something that's beautiful. So I wonder if it's also a time pattern, like, you know, it's kind of like what you're saying, you know, you kind of, she is getting the sympathy for him because she knows him after the fact. She doesn't know what he's done. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of, so I think that sort of relates to that, evil, and whether they're born or if it's kind of crazy, but wow, it's pretty interesting. Where do you do research for these types of books?
Oh, the Kill Club was, well, okay. So I like to do interviews personally. Hunting Annabelle, I interviewed a psychiatrist. I interviewed all different people. Kill Club, I interviewed survivors of all the situations in the Kill Club. Like, they're the members of the Kill Club are in all these desperate situations. Those, I think I ended up using, 10 of them or so. I had dozens of firsthand accounts of people I started out with this research question, which was, have you ever been in a situation where if a murder club like this was available, you would have been tempted to use it? Have you ever been in a situation like that? And I asked women around me, and I know women go through stuff like this all the time. I know it, and men too, but I think it's fair to say that this is something that happens more often to women. Mm-hmm. And I had so many stories from women that I had to choose between them of, I had this, the story of the woman who's being stalked at work. He's breaking into her apartment. They won't renew the restraining order. The story of the mother whose kid gets taken away because, she's queer and the ex-husband's a lawyer, like all the stories in that book. There were so many that didn't go in that I couldn't put in there. I just ran out of space. And that was really, I did about a year of that kind of research while I was working on something else. And
that's going to be hard, right? Because when I interview these people, I find it can be really stressful. So it's got to be hard at times. Were there any surprises?
I think the biggest surprise was how common it was that almost everyone I knew had some story, my neighbor, when my husband died, my neighbor was mad that I got dogs and he poisoned them. Or, there's story after story after story of like, and the police wouldn't do anything and they wouldn't do anything and they wouldn't do anything. And there was story after story of that. And so there's just so many ways to victimize someone outside the law. Or I guess inside the law, where there isn't. And so I just was surprised by how common. I wasn't surprised, but I was surprised. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right. And
I thought I'd get a few stories.
It's endless. It's endless. So the characters you used in, let's say, the Kill Club, like Carol, the foster mm-hmm. mother and stuff, now, are they taken from the stories themselves, or are they totally a creative fictional person that you have and you just put them into an event?
The main characters in the Kill Club are all created, and Carol is kind of like a compilation of a number of different people that I've, I think that's how a lot of our characters are. We have a type of person we want to write about, but it's not a straight person. It's, you've met a number of people that remind you of this, but yeah, there's no one who's like a main character in the Kill Club who's straight from life. And I never do that. I never take main characters straight from life. It just doesn't seem fair. I'll take a side character straight from life. Like if I need a really realistic guy in a scene, I'll take him straight from life. People don't mind that, but I would never take like a real person.
If you're in a supermarket and some really nasty person cuts you off or said something bad to you, do you take that person and make them suffer?
I have written in a couple of people.
There we go.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Oh, now we're getting to it.
Yeah, I don't usually write them in and like kill them. It'll be like I'll write them into a really douchey character. Mm. And I'll be like, that's who you are.
That was funny. I still love that question because I got one of the first crime fiction writers I interviewed was J.D. Horn. And he said that he used to, someone cut him off or said something or was rude to him in the bank or in the store, he would take that character and give them a really bad death. And I thought, wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
Torture them. All right.
I'm not going for coffee with you.
I know. I feel like that tells you something about him. You know, it's like, and it tells you something about me. Like, I want you exposed for your truth. He wants to, like, murder you badly.
Yeah. He's got some information built up there.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, he's got to get an outlet. But, yeah, I find crime fiction writers really interesting. You've got a new book coming out on March 30th of this year, so that's exciting. She's Too Pretty to Burn.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, got it right. And so
the great title.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Give us a little bit of a rundown on this. What kind of a story is it?
Well, it's more of my artsy weird stuff, you know. it's so fun. I'm so excited this one's coming out. But this is a Dorian Gray reimagining where it's gender swapped. So Dorian Gray is a teenage girl who is an unwilling muse for the photographer who falls in love with her. So it's like a romance between the two main characters, Mick and Veronica. Veronica is an aspiring photographer and Mick is a swimmer who has a fear of being photographed, like a real fear, like a phobia fear of being photographed because her mom's a model and has always forced this on her and she like hates it. And so the story starts off with them getting involved with each other and Veronica taking this one picture of Mick after their first kiss that she puts on Instagram and it goes wildly viral and takes over everything in a way that is really exciting for Veronica and very dark and claustrophobic for Mick. And so Mick gets sort of looped into Veronica's best friend, Nico's antics. He is an installation artist and he does what he thinks of as disruptive installation art, kind of like a more dangerous type of Banksy sort of art, like where you're sneaking into places and installing these dangerous, disruptive installations. And so the story kind of takes a downturn from there and it becomes all very dark and murdery and artsy.
Sounds great.
Thanks.
Well, you can tell what he likes. Go for it.
Well, I mean, I'm a high school teacher by trade, so I'm thinking about, you know, it's a YA novel and you're basing it on Dorian Gray, which is a book that for many years I taught to students, you know, with some success and some, you know, depending on. And they were always hooked on the story, right? So it's a great, yeah. I mean, it's some of those, sometimes the language was hard for them, but they're always hooked on the story. So it's such a great choice to, you know, reimagine.
Well, thank you.
Nice to have a book to recommend students as well.
Well, I don't know if you've ever noticed when you're reading Dorian Gray, but Oscar Wilde is like hella misogynistic. I mean, that guy says mean things about women.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, I was kind of delighted about the idea of like gender swapping his book because I just felt like it would piss him off in a way that made me really satisfied. Like, girls don't deserve this story. Women are just decorative, he says. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's very misogynistic.
Times have changed mm-hmm. a little. mm-hmm. I say a little, depending on what place you're in, but that's crazy. It's crazy that all the stuff that goes on, you know, like Dr. Seuss and all these different things, and mm-hmm. people are waking up to things. And I think it's hard for a lot of people to move forward with changes, you know, but it's happening. Does this sort of affect the way you write? Because you're writing in modern times here, right? So do you feel like you have to be careful on how you get into a story and how people are in the story, how your characters act?
Absolutely. I mean, I want to make sure that, like, the last thing I want is to spend all this time working on something and then to accidentally alienate a reader just because I didn't take the time to do my research on where society and culture is at right now. You know, I mean, I'm very all for, like, if one of my books, you know, in the long term is, you know, it turns out that I, you know, the message isn't no longer aging well and it doesn't belong on the shelf anymore. It's like, take it off. I can, you know, it's like, art's not permanent. I don't know where the idea came to us from that any of this was supposed to be permanent, you know, that just because someone becomes a famous author like Dr. Seuss, we never signed a contract to shelve Dr. Seuss for all of eternity. You know, culture changes. Like, I don't know why, I don't know why it's so upsetting to people to think that that nothing is sacred, everything is temporal. It's like, yeah, it's yeah. life. We will, you know,
that's a hard thing to accept, I think, for people. And I think mm-hmm. there's a lot of people, you know, baby boomers that grow up with, you know, a majority of the people out there that are upset had never been writers themselves, probably. Mm-hmm. And so in their ideas, they were taught with certain books and certain ideas, and now they're, you know, 70 years old or whatever age they are now. And it seems like I think they feel like what they did is they're being told everything was wrong. It's all bad. Mm-hmm. And I think yeah. that's sort of it. I think a person doesn't want to live 70 years and then look back and then have the younger generation say, well, everything you did is wrong. You were terrible. You know, I think that's sort of in a roundabout way, I think that's why a lot mm-hmm. of people get upset.
Why it hits that nerve.
Yeah. I mean, you know, because in a way, you know, Charlie Brown will be next.
yeah.
Right? But I grew up with Charlie Brown. So I don't know. I kind of get both sides of it. But yeah, you're right. There is no permanent, you know, some things last and some things don't, you know.
Yeah. It's like we get this idea that because something gets really entrenched in culture, that it's not a sandcastle. It's not a sandcastle. I built it up on this really tall hill. It's not a sandcastle. But like, the sea level is rising, and even the sandcastles that are built on really tall hills are still sandcastles, and eventually the sea will rise. And that is true for all art.
Well, you could have bought Winston Churchill's painting for $11 million. That's crazy in itself, right? But, you know, that's society.
Yeah.
That's society. So does this sort of the pandemic, and this last year has been crazy, right? You know, with, you know, Master Trump
and
all of the stuff going on, like the whole mm-hmm. thing, you know, that you could go endless, you know, Jewish laser beams and fake snow in Texas.
I forgot about the Jewish laser beams.
Thanks for the reminder. Bill Gates used Jewish laser beams to create fake snow in Texas, right? You know, build off this. But with all of that in the world today, there's two parts to this question. One is, you know, because how does this affect your writing? And I mean, one as in with so much uncertainty around you, you know, the neighbors, the world and all that, does that make your writing darker? And the other part of this is, are you going to include any of this chaos in your writing? Because you do write for, you know, in modern times.
That's really interesting. You know, all of us behind the scenes are asking each other, are you putting the pandemic in your book? Are you putting the pandemic in your book? And for the most part, I think it's a no. But because, I mean, first of all, I think it's interesting to consider this angle. It's not only what I feel like writing, it's what editors feel like reading if you're trying to sell books right now. Editors don't aren't in the mood for stories that might feel claustrophobic or be heavy and depressing, because life is so heavy and depressing and claustrophobic, you know. So I actually did write and shelve an entire book while on pandemic, because I was really excited going into this book because it was really claustrophobic and like rainy cabin in the woods type of vibes. And I forced myself to finish that thing, but like, man, I did not enjoy writing that. And I was just like, time for the shelf, time to write a different book. So yeah, I definitely, so now I have like two different books that I'm working on, and they're both pretty like travel-y, adventure-y, beachy, like sunny settings. And I'm finding it like, yeah, I think that I need to give myself a setting that feels like when I'm writing, I feel like I'm out in the world and on adventures, because I am stuck inside so much in California. You know, we're shut down. I mean, we are like shut down, except we're lucky to have good weather to be out and like hiking and stuff. But
yeah,
you know, we've been shut down for like most of this year.
Yeah.
Well, so, yeah,
just move to Texas. They're opening up. Good.
I've already done that.
Been there, done that. Don't want to do it again.
I want to say, I don't want to hate on Texas, because I actually really miss Texas. Texas is cool. People in Texas are very warm. You know, the culture is very casual, very chill, very warm. I do miss Texas all the time. So no hate on Texas.
There are some great people in Texas. It's just, just a couple of people, but, but that's fantastic. So in a way it has affected your writing. You are kind of turning it around and writing a little bit lighter then, right?
I would say it's not any lighter, as far as there's not like less death, there's not less darkness psychologically, but the settings, I'm like really not wanting to write like indoor settings right now. I'm really wanting to write like travel-y or outdoor settings right now, adventure-y.
Huh. So does when things are really kind of dark around you, it doesn't necessarily make you write darker then?
It will have me write darker, like, for example, Hunting Annabelle. That's really dark psychologically, but like the settings and stuff in it are quite fun. Like he's in this amusement park all the time. He's out in, he's on this road trip in Texas. You know, he's climbing around and breaking and entering. So like the settings are fun, but the psychology is really dark. And that's what I tend to do. Like I was cooped up when I was writing that. That's like the same type of thing I'm doing right now. Like really fun settings, but really dark content. Actually, maybe that's a brand I have, because Kill Club was like that too. And so She's Too Pretty to Burn is like that too. Huh. Never really thought about that.
Yeah. Well, you know. So now on the new book, I always like to find out why you write a book. So what made you write this new book, She's Too Pretty to Burn? What was the fire behind this?
It started with a single idea, Dorian Gray, but with photography. And then it just kind of took off from there. Yeah. This idea that like a photograph on social media could have the speculative element. Like you don't need the speculative element, because the way photographs can go viral can create that magic of sudden fame or of sudden distress, you know, and sort of like subbing in social media algorithms as the magic was really interesting. And then just the idea of like a teenage girl photographer and a teenage girl, you know, subject, because it's all about vanity and like, who am I as the subject of this art? It just felt like teenage girls were like the perfect people to explore this with.
Did you set out to write a YA novel, or is it just the idea kind of summoned that up? What was your approach to that? And in writing a YA novel, did you have to think differently about how you might set up a thriller?
It was kind of like my agent does a lot of YA. And she was like, if you're interested in writing this YA book, I know an editor I can pitch to or I can work with. She knew that I was hoping to sell something on proposal and not have to do a whole spec manuscript at that point. So it just kind of worked out where she was working with this editor, and the editor really liked the story idea. And it just had to be a YA book because that's a YA editor. But besides, I really wanted to work with this editor And rightfully so, she is awesome. I love working with that editor. I will like follow her through the universe. I love her so much. And so, yeah, I mean, it just kind of worked out that she's a very collaborative editor. So she had like a lot of ideas on what she thought would be good for the project. And I really like that type of collaboration where you're bouncing ideas off each other. And so the idea just kind of formed organically, and then, you know, put the proposal together and send drafts back and forth. And then, you know, you got your idea.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like, I mean, I'm first of all, I agree with you. Like I really enjoy a great editor is gold, and
yeah,
and also that one that's collaborative that way. It's just like heaven, because you're, mm-hmm. it is such a lonely thing writing. And,
mm-hmm.
And did you have to, in writing this book, you know, since it is sort of maybe a slightly different audience than your other books, did you have to do anything in particular in terms of the crafting of the book for that audience? Is it, in other words, writing YA, did you have to wear a slightly different hat or make
yeah.
a choice? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Really different, because, you know, like if I'm writing The Kill Club, I'm speaking to moms, I'm speaking to adult women, I'm speaking to adult men, you know, non-binary people. I'm speaking to people who are in their 30s, 40s, most of the time, 50s, you know. With She's Too Pretty to Burn, my audience is teenage girls age 14 to 18. And so I felt responsibility. Like I want to play more carefully with them, you know, and I want to respect what I'm saying to them and realize that, you know, the things that are said to teenage girls are often so destructive and so thoughtless. And I really wanted to be very thoughtful about the kind of things I was saying to them, especially in regards to things like sexuality and gender and the place of social media. And I really wanted to get into issues of consent outside of just sex. Like I wanted to get into issues of consent with photographs, and like the importance of consent in photography and what it means to have photographs are permanent. Like what does it mean to have something on the internet? And I just really want, not in a preachy way, but I wanted to make them feel seen. Like these are real issues that they're dealing with all the time. And I wanted to, you know, be in that conversation with them in a way that made them feel validated, seen, important, that made their feelings seem important, that made their, you know, concerns seem important. And I just wanted to be a constructive voice in it, in that conversation. And also I wanted to give them something that was really enjoyable and like fun and twisty and dark and sexy and all the things that help, you know, get someone into a story so that you can think about those larger issues without it being preachy and without it being annoying or heavy. Like I wanted to do that all in like a really fun but dark way. So I felt like I had like pretty high hopes for this story, and it did take a lot of emotional, it did take an emotional toll trying to get all that in and feeling that weight of like, God, you know, these are kids reading this, I want to make sure I'm doing this right, you know.
Right.
So, yeah.
What advice do you give to someone that's a new writer?
I often say I often recommend just studying a lot and writing a lot, like studying, like reading a new craft book every time you write a draft, read a new craft book, write a draft, read a new craft book, write a draft, keep writing until it feels less precious, and keep that volume up of learning and writing and learning and writing. I recommend that is a good way to.
Who do you get your inspiration from? Is it other writers or do you look elsewhere?
Like inspiration to write? Like
yeah,
inspiration
like to, what, do yeah. you, what do you think gets into you when you write? Like what, you know, or if you're stuck one day or if you're just kind of in a zone yeah. where things aren't happening. Is there some sort of thing that you can go to, like music or other writers?
Yeah. I have to create like playlists for each book to help me get in the mood, like get the vibe of the book. So like I'll have a really extensive or some smaller playlist that I'll listen to like on repeat while I'm drafting. That really helps me get the headspace, like the visualization of the book. And I need to do things like walk and drive to kind of clear my head. So to going on a long walk and, you know, and thinking about a scene, or going on a long walk and thinking about a book I want to write, plus putting in music that feels like the right vibe, and just kind of like letting that spark inspiration. That tends to be where I'll go when I'm needing inspiration.
So you put Metallica on and go for a drive?
Something like that, yeah. Something like that, or a walk.
Run over.
Do you ever make your playlists and share them like on Spotify? Or
I do. I always have a Spotify playlist for each book I publish, and I always share them. And I always put them on my website and stuff like that. I think it's fun. No one ever seems to care. I think it's fun.
That's I have to check it out. I don't even know. I didn't know the Kill Club had a playlist.
Oh my God, the Kill Club definitely has a playlist.
That's a great idea, actually. Do you ever think of going into like true crime or anything, or jumping over because you're so close to it now?
I have a book. I have a book that I've been wanting to write forever. That's in that vein. Yes, actually, there's a serial murderer that I did a lot of research on that I've always wanted to write a book about. The research to do that book would be really tough, like a lot of in-person digging through back files and stuff. So I'm not sure if I'll ever be able to do it, but yeah, definitely.
Yeah. But it sounds like you're close to that now anyway, in a sense, because you're doing a lot of interviews and you're kind of going through stuff. That's kind of what it is. It's just, it takes time, but it's not, you know, stuff like that. Well, so how is your day spent then? What do you do day to day in writing? Like how does the great Wendy Heard write?
Oh my God. Well, I have a day job. So I write from like 5:30 in the morning until 7:30 in the morning every day before work. And then on the weekends, I usually get in a good 3-4 hour writing session on Saturday mornings as well. So I just don't sleep in ever. And then when I'm on deadline, I'll write in every weird place you can think of. Like, you know, I'll drive my daughter to a thing and I'm writing in my car, writing in the stairwell, writing in my car, writing in, you know, in the reception of the place where she's doing gymnastics. I mean, like, I just kind of piece it all together. It's like patchwork.
Can you turn it on like that? But I have a difficulty doing that, to say, okay, well, I'm going to schedule, you know, from 5 to 7 tonight or whatever and write. And then to actually sit down at 5 and then to turn it on and just be able to write. You can do that?
I plan it all. Like, so the night before, I know tomorrow morning I'm writing a scene. So I have my scene planned out that I'm going to write tomorrow morning. And I'm picturing it in my head all evening. I'm like, okay, they're going to be here. They're going to be there. How am I going to work out that? Will they say this? Is it more of like this vibe? And I'll kind of think that, then I'll go to sleep and I'll wake up in the morning and I'll go. And then before I turn off my computer for that session, I'll make notes for my next scene. Okay, from here, here's what's going to happen. And I'll kind of make notes in the file for the next scene. And then all day throughout the day, I'll be like marinating on it. Okay, so they're going to do this, they're going to do this. And then, you know, the next morning I'll have it in my head and then so forth. So when I'm really on a deadline, that's how I'll do it. And that usually gets the job done.
That's interesting. So what's your relationship like with your characters? I say that because a lot of fiction writers will say they're like my children or things like that. What's your response? Like, how do you feel about your characters?
I do love them. I mean, Jazz is my favorite of all my characters I've ever written. She's my little baby angel in the Kill Club. She's the one who has like the most, I put more of like personal stuff into Jazz because she's from LA. She's from working class LA. And so I let Jazz have a lot more of me than I normally give any one character. And then sometimes, you know what? Sometimes I don't have a close relationship with them. And it's like a professional working relationship. You know, I'm like, we don't know each other that well, but we're working together on this project. So sometimes I just don't, that'll never happen with a main character, but like a close side character. Sometimes I really just struggle to get the flavor of somebody and I'll have to really like work at it.
Where does that come from when you say that, to struggle to get the flavor of a character? Because, you know, because when I go out and meet someone, they're actually who they are. So it's, for me, it's to figure that out. For you, it's in your mind, so to speak. So I just wonder, how do you know, like, for instance, how a person's going to react, what they're going to say, and their moods?
Yeah, sometimes I have to just write a draft where I don't know them very well, and I just got to try different things. And then I'll be like, okay, you know what? I think what I'm going to do is that when this person gets angry, they tend to make jokes. That's their defense mechanism. Like, okay, when they feel defensive, they lash out, you know, and I'll just get to know them better as I'm trying to see how they react to all the things that kind of come at them. I'll know from the beginning, like, are they really confrontational? They're not. They're self-effacing, or they're, you know, funny. And sometimes I have to assign it to them. Like, okay, you're going to be funny. Like, I don't know you, but I've decided you're going to be funny. And I'll try to, like, you know, make that work, you know, because I'm just struggling so hard to get their characterization. That can be really hard, you know. And then I do a lot of passes. Like, I'll do a whole pass for this character's particular way of talking, or I'll do a whole pass for this character's physical habits, making sure that the way they handle their body is consistent throughout the book and that stuff.
Wow. It's quite the process. Now, do you have a website? Do you have a place that you want people to come and stalk you or send you letters?
Yes, come stalk me at wendyheard.com.
Well, that's easy. We'll have that up on our website as well, so people listening can just find you with one click, and they can just click and run. So I know this is a weird. So what's next for you? What's next? Because I know this book's coming out the 31st, so it's soon come out. But I know, as being a writer, that you've probably got something else in the wings already going.
You know, but you know, it's all publishing. It's like, oh, you've got stuff happening. You can tell people in 5 years, you know.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
there are books coming. I do have some stuff that should be announced pretty soon here. And then other stuff that I have, like, for example, I have a book I'm writing on spec, and that one, we'll see what happens. That's an adult thriller that I just set aside to finish something else, but I'm going to pick that back up. And I hope, you know, I'm hoping to finish that later in the year and see what happens with that one. And then I have something young adult that I'm working on right now as well. So yeah, I'm hoping to finish two books this year. We'll see what happens with them. Let's see where the little book babies end up.
Well, I'm sure you will. Our guest today has been Wendy Hurd, and the book, we've been talking about all three of her books, but her newest book, which is coming out the 30th of March, waking up, Al, it's She's Too Pretty to Burn. Thank you for being here, Wendy.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a great conversation. I really enjoyed it.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.